Modified the name a little bit to Hack Nano. Go to www.hacknano.com after Monday, and I'll have more information about this speech. The site is really not designed to be a commercial site or anything like that. It's more like my personal notebook where I keep some notes, maybe some ideas, just brainstorming. It's not very organized right now, but it works. Hacknano.com. So, how many people were here by show of hands were here for the H2K2 Hacking Nanotech?
All right, I guess a couple people.
Welcome back. I'm glad to see you're still interested. As you may remember, at the H2K2 speech, I emphasized heavily on software simulation of nanotechnology and hacking nanotech. I didn't believe that hacking nanotech was possible. I proved myself wrong in 2 years, and I will get to that. PowerPoint. Hacknano.com. All things are possible. When humans can accurately manipulate the basic building blocks of all matter, atoms, when humans can accurately manipulate atoms, all things are possible. That is the fundamental theory behind my project. You can read into that. All good things are possible and all bad things are possible. So what is nano? Nanotechnology. Nanofabrication. I'll be using cutoffs of the words like nanotech, nanofab. Micro is 1 million. Nano is 1 billion. The unit of measure that we are interested here is distance. So it would be nanometer. What is a nanometer? Well, it's 1 billionth of a meter. Exactly how small is 1 billionth of a meter? This slide shows you a couple colored spheres. The blue sphere on the far right is a raindrop, measuring 610,000 microns. Then we go down the line and we get familiar with things that are smaller. Plant spores is represented by the green sphere. Smaller yet, fungus spores, 5 to 30 microns. Even smaller, we have bacteria. This is actual living creatures, bacteria, 3 to 5 microns. And then we have smoke particles. And you might not even be able to see it, but there's an arrow there that says virus. 0.003 to 0.05 microns. That's a quick representation of nanometer. Here's something you might be a little bit more familiar with. The diameter of a human hair. It's said to average between 80,000 and 200,000 nanometers. This pink scale here represents 100 microns or 100,000 nanometers. No one, I believe, here has eyes good enough to be able to see the actual follicles of the scales on a hair. But they exist. And this picture was taken with a scanning electron microscope at 200,000 keV. A nanometer is small, but what is nanotechnology? What is nanofabrication? Nanofabrication sort of has two definitions depending on who's using it. General industry and the semiconductor industry, the general usage of nanotechnology is defined as the manufacture of devices less than 100 nanometers. Remember again that the cross-section of a human hair is 100,000 nanometers. So we're building circuits which would fit on the cross-section of a hair many times over. Science fiction and more theory-based science defines nanofab as the precise manipulation of atoms. The graphics on this slide are the picture of what do we got there? It looks like a transistor, CMOS transistor. And on the right, we have a water molecule. There are your two realms here. We have the semiconductor industry and basic science. So generating devices less than 100 nanometers, manipulating individual atoms. How far is human society away from doing that? Are we there yet? The answer to that is yes, we are there. Pentium 3s use 90 nanometer technology, where 90 nanometers is the smallest dimension on the Pentium 3. It's called critical dimension. It's usually, if I'm not mistaken, the the width of the gate on the transistor. Xbox 2, which is set to come out soon. Xbox 2, which is set to come out soon, will be using 65 nanometer technology. This is definitely a push, seeing as a lot of industry leaders warned that 90 nanometers was the barrier. Everyone knows barriers are meant to be broken. Here comes 65 nanometer on a game station. In the early 1990s, IBM spelled out its logo using 35 xenon atoms on a nickel substrate. They used an atomic force microscope to drag individual atoms of xenon across a nickel substrate using the atomic force microscope needle. And it took about 20 hours, I believe, to do that. It took a lot of time, but it worked. They actually manipulated individual atoms. Currently, present day, atomic lithography is being studied all the time. The graphics here, we have an Intel Pentium 3, an Xbox, and the image of the IBM spelled out with 35 xenon atoms. The white bumps represent the individual xenon atoms. Again, taken with a scanning electron microscope, I believe, or an atomic force microscope, probably. And then the image on the right represents IBM, very simple logo. They only use 35 atoms. The image on the right, a little bit more fancy, a little bit more intricate. We've perfected the technology a little bit more in the last 10 years. The atomic lithography is growing of, it's a, you could say growing or depositing of atoms, precisely. So this talks about semiconductor industry, moving some atoms around, building smaller and super faster transistors. But nanotechnology and nanofabrication is not just for semiconductors. Remember again that we're building devices which are as small and even smaller than viruses and bacteria. Transistors in the Xbox 2 are going to be roughly the same size as some bacteria, or even smaller. So we have biotechnology being an important role player in the development of nanotechnology. Because we're building such small things, NanoFab opens the doors for biotechnology. It allows people who are biologists to use some of the same equipment and ideals that semiconductor industry leaders have been using for a long time. One of those developments is microreactors. A microreactor is often referred to as a lab on a chip. It's a chip where a chemical reaction is created, or cells are grown, and the effects are studied on a much smaller scale, and most of the time a computer is used. The image in the upper left shows the diagram of a biotin and strepto. I knew I'd messed that one up. Streptavidin chemical reaction. I don't remember exactly what it does. I'm not a big chemistry guy myself. But the interesting thing is we have several mixture of chemicals going on in nanometer sized or even micrometer sized channels, and these channels are etched into glass, or often called silicon dioxide. But then there's a point at which the reaction is studied, and a computer chip is put underneath there. After that, the materials travel into a section of the chip, which is waste. And that's pretty interesting, because now you don't have to take test tubes, which could contain milliliters and milliliters of chemicals. And you could mix them, and you end up with liters or even more of waste material, stuff you have to somehow dispose of. This could be toxic. Using microreactors, we reduce the amount of waste material to a lot less. And also, imagine a company has spent billions of dollars developing a new cure for some disease, but they've only been able to develop several small vials of it. They have to put that new drug, which may be a life-saving drug, through an amazing gauntlet of tests to make sure it works. But they can't exhaust their supply of the chemical, or else they'll have to spend a lot more to redevelop it. By reducing the amount of expensive chemicals that are used, we allow it to stretch the budget. We can make drugs cheaper this way. Also, transporting a toxic chemical that must be used in a test becomes a lot easier. You don't have to transport a liter of it on an airplane. You only have to transport maybe a small 6-inch box that contains the microreactor with the chemical already loaded. These are actual circuits here. In the upper right is a dime showing you a comparison of the microreactor. Those are channels etched in glass. The bottom left is a device made by a company called Nanogen. They actually produce these chips commercially, and actually they sell a separate computer. Those little dots are like pins on a CPU. It connects into a computer, and the reaction is studied by the computer sensor. So not only does nanotechnology have biotech applications and semiconductor applications, it also has medical applications. They're trying to build small robots. A blood cell is 10,000 nanometers across. We're building circuits that are 65 nanometers. We're not just building circuits anymore. We're not building transistors. We're building channels in glass. We're building tubes. We're actually even building gears, physical moving parts. Here's an obscure movie reference. Threw that one in there. That's actually the most colorful slide I have, I think. Innerspace was a movie based on the principle that a small robot is shrunken down and injected into his body, and you see the size of the robot in comparison to some of the things inside his body: blood cells, the bloodstream, organs, the stomach. But how far away are we from that? That technology, the manufacturing of small electromechanical systems, micro-electromechanical systems, is MEMS. These are micron-sized machines. We're talking on a physics level now. They have gears, cantilevers, springs, flaps, rotating components, twisting components. Microtechnology is a more appropriate term for this, but it's getting shoveled in with the nanotechnology aspect because it is so small, and it's things that are being designed in labs right now. In the future, it will enable small robotic devices the same size as bacteria, viruses, and cells. Also, MEMS is being explored heavily in fiber optic technology. The ability to move a flap or flex a mirror and deflect an optical beam allows you to create pure optical switches and routers. Something which right now I believe they use, they convert to electrical and then back to optical to do. Pure optical routers and switches will make for a much faster backbone. So here's some more SEM pictures of some common stuff here. We got a red and a white blood cell, the red blood cell being on the left, measuring 10,000 nanometers. The picture in the upper left is a small gear and cantilever. You can see its scale there. I don't know if everybody can see it, but it's 50 micron, the white line. What is also pictured in that picture is pollen, which has fallen onto the cantilever section. You can see now that when you're working with this technology, you've got to have a clean environment. If pollen were to fall in this gear, it would destroy it. It's like throwing a wrench into a running V8. The picture in the bottom left is colorized. Most SEM, I guess all SEMs, they do not take color pictures. So what you might find out on some internet sites when you do some research on nanotechnology is artwork. Some art students like to take SEM pictures and put color to them, make them look kind of high sci-fi and stuff. The item on the bottom right, I believe, is a combination lock that was developed. What actually functions and has a 3-digit code. It locks into a set position when you enter the code using an atomic force microscope and move the gears around. It's kind of interesting. We're adding physical security on a micron scale. It makes it very more difficult to social engineer your way into this one. Products today which use nanotechnology. I did a little bit of research. I didn't look too hard for this, but these were some of the things I thought were neat that came up. Curad silver bandages use films of silver to promote healing. Silver is a great antibacterial agent, and it's naturally waterproof. Using nanofilms of silver over a wound can promote healing. So Curad silver bandages are out on the market now, I believe. I haven't seen them in the store yet. In fact, the only thing I've seen so far on this was the Wilson tennis balls, but I'm not sure yet. Eagle One Nano Wax. Use nanotechnology to create smaller wax particles. Now, why would you want smaller wax particles? When you have a scratch or a rough mark in your paint job, you want to be able to smooth that over and make it level again. The only way to do that is to make particles small enough that would go inside the crack. Eagle One Nano Wax uses nano-sized particles of wax which fill in the grooves. Other waxes today use larger particles which do not, and consequently do not hide the scratches as well. Wilson, who makes tennis rackets and tennis balls, they make a double core tennis ball, which uses a nanoparticle coating to trap the air inside the rubber, doubling the lifetime of the tennis ball. Any tennis fans here? Tennis balls are made out of natural rubber in order to get the authentic bounce of a tennis ball. The problem with natural rubber is that it dries out within, was it 2 months, 2 weeks? I forget if it's two, but they doubled it to four. I forgot if it was months or weeks. But natural latex rubber dries out. Using a nanoparticle coating, they were able to trap the air inside the rubber, keeping it from drying out and prolonging the lifespan of it without affecting the unique bounce qualities which tennis players have become accustomed to with tennis balls. I didn't realize the manufacture of a tennis ball was so critical, but it does make sense now. NanoDry is a company which makes clothing. This clothing uses nano-sized particles to absorb moisture and prevent bacteria growth. I believe they're also using silver in this department. And another example of a clothing which uses nanotechnology are the new StainGuard Docker pants. I believe they use nanoparticles of Teflon woven in with the fabric. This keeps the water or any liquid material from sticking to the pants. The problem with those pants is after about 40 washes, the nano coating, the nanoparticle coating falls off. Also with the nano dry clothing, I heard they only last 40 to 50 washes also. But those commercials that they show, the guy flipping all over in the car with his drink all over his lap and he gets out and it's perfectly fine, those are real. Those pants do work like that. It's pretty interesting. That's current nanotechnology. These are things that are being developed right now that already exist. These are things which are real. What is the future of nanotechnology? Idealistically, the cheap manufacturing of anything. Being able to build machines which replicate themselves before building the desired object allows you to create the object very cheap. All you have to do is build one, and it will build itself, and then build the object, and then disintegrate or extinguish itself. Using nanotubes, nanotechnology is really exploring the concept of materials with superior qualities. We're talking superconductivity, ultra tensile strength, maximum flexibility without breaking. Carbon fibers were once thought of as the great fiber which could do everything, bend any way and not break. Nanotubes are also made out of carbon, and they're being used in a lot of objects today. Or a lot of research today to promote materials with better qualities. Building perfect steel, which can flex 180 degrees and return back to its shape without having any cracks. And quantum computation. This is a catch-all for ultra-fast computers. I mean, we're talking past 3 gig, we're talking the ability to store an immense amount of data on a small medium. That's the good side. That's the good side of the future of nanotechnology. Some of the things which have been shown to be dangerous outcomes of nanotechnology are real viruses. Remember, again, we are manipulating individual atoms. What is a virus? It's a special arrangement of proteins. What are proteins? A special arrangement of molecules. What are molecules? A special arrangement of atoms. If we can manipulate atoms, we can build molecules, we can build proteins, and we can build viruses. We can also manipulate an existing virus, take out a couple molecules of one type and put in a new one, move whole proteins around. You could create uber viruses, real viruses that exist in the real world. That definitely, I think, stands out as one of the great things that nanotechnology is capable of doing, but is also dangerous. Disastrous genetic manipulation. Being able to manipulate the genetic structure of any organism precisely allows you to create such crazy science fiction things like animals that are extremely bloodthirsty, or, you know, crazy stuff like that. But being able to manipulate the gene map of an animal allows you to create custom characteristics of it. So with nanotechnology, someone with less than honest intentions could do that. And then also the goo scenarios. These are scenarios which some scientists feel may be possible. I mentioned before about cheap manufacturing of objects using self-replicating machines. If a machine is self-replicating, it has to take some fuel apart to create itself. If you did not design that fuel to be something which is unique, if you design the fuel to be something like sugar, a replicator could reproduce itself very quickly if it were let loose. There's sugar everywhere. But if you make a special fuel that it has to break apart to build itself, then you stem the chance that it could break loose. And what you have here is a situation where there is a constant, everything that the replicator comes in touch with, it is able to take apart and rebuild a new replicator, which then, of course, can take apart and build another new replicator. And what you have is a world ending up in a ball of green or gray glue. Also, green goo, gray goo, and blue goo, I believe, are the three main goo scenarios. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Personally, I don't agree. I've spoken to some PhD people about this because I thought it was interesting, and that's what I was told too, that it is kind of a sci-fi interesting thing, but there hasn't been enough research done on it yet to prove that it's a possible runaway cataclysmic event that could happen. So here we have the good and the bad, and we come back to the point: all things are possible. That's nanotechnology. Hacking. The reason we're all here today. Hackers learn, they explore, discover, invent, build, and often hackers break the barriers of technology. When someone said, "You can't make a computer that can do this," a hacker said, "I will do it," and they have done it. So they break the barriers of technology. They push the limits of what an object is designed for. And they also warn. If a hacker is able to observe something which they may feel in the future could be dangerous, they're able to get out and warn people. Right now, we're not doing so good. Our warning systems in place are getting other hackers in trouble. Hopefully, by the time true nanotechnology is realized, maybe hackers will have a better forum to voice their concerns. So we have hacking, and we have nano, and we have hack nano. What is hacking nano? Nano hackers learn about nanotechnology, read, research, experiment. Explore, look for information everywhere they can. Spread this information. Sometimes information about nanotechnology, which is a very new field, is obscure, is actually sometimes even secret. So I believe the goal of a nano hacker and a goal of my project is to spread the information about nanotechnology, to let others know what's going on. To dispel some of the negative aspects which nanotechnology may take on, that it's dangerous and that I'm building crazy machines up here. We all need to get out and tell people, and especially the media, that this is not something to be 100% feared. It is to be questioned and learned about, not completely put to the side as something dangerous. We're all familiar with that. Experiment with nanotechnology with little regard for financial gain. I would say almost all of the research of nanotechnology done right now is purely for financial gain. Somebody wants to make money off an idea. So a nano hacker would, it's a hobby. It's sometimes even more than a hobby. It's a desire, a drive to experiment, to learn, to spread that information, and to build new things with little regard for actually making money off of it. I mean, we've all probably had situations where we've sat in front of a computer for hours at a time and didn't make a single penny from it. But we come away with a feeling of accomplishment that we've created something good. Exposed threats overlooked by profit and power-driven entities. Power-driven entities like the government, profit-driven entities like corporation. Corporations may be mindset on developing a particular aspect of nanotechnology while completely disregarding the fact that it could be harmful for nature or harmful to humans. Hackers with information about nanotechnology are able to sort of look over their shoulder and see what they're doing, find out what they're researching, find out what they're learning, tell other people about it, see what they think about it, just spread it around, see where there could be a problem. This to me is most like finding exploits or finding things that could be exploited. And one of the other things I feel is very important for nanohacking is to enhance the life for all humankind. We carry with nanotechnology, all things are possible. So I believe it's important for hackers of nanotechnology to use what they've learned to enhance humankind. Because the negative effects are so profound, we have to take the positive effects and apply them before they're hoarded out for money or hoarded out for new weapons. We've come back around to hacking nano, all things are possible. This is some of the equipment of nanofabrication. Any effective hacker has to have tools. Any effective nano hacker has to have tools. These are some of the tools and equipment of nanotechnology. It's just a random collage of objects. The point here was to show a sci-fi looking device, but also to show that they have some things in common. They have what's called a chamber, an area where the action occurs. They have support devices and support systems. You see wires and tubes and all kinds of things going all over the place on the item on the right, which is an electron beam lithography tool. Each wire, each tube has a specific purpose in order to create an electron beam which can write on a silicon surface or etch away chromium on a glass surface down to a very precise scale. All this equipment in here costs a lot of money. These are all pictures of equipment at a research place, and they had a lot of money to throw around. Some of the equipment was donated from industry, but we're talking hundreds of thousands per device, several million. The e-beam tool, I believe, is several million dollars, a budget which I currently am not equipped to handle. So the next important thing is what type of equipment is used in nanotechnology. Here's a small list. We have vacuum technology, lithography, plasma, electron beams, ion beams, microscopy. And without deep pockets or direct access to nanotechnology, hackers must build their own tools. When we don't have the money to pay for a proprietary piece of software, most of us write our own. We don't just go out and steal it. I heard that. But building tools. How do we get started? In the beginning, hackers created the PC. There were research projects going on for what they were calling a computer calculating machine, and hackers would take home some of the devices that were thrown out during the course of their workday. Their 8-hour shift was up. They got to go home. They decided to take something out of the trash and take it home, and for the next 8 hours of their own free time, try to make it work at home. They tried to replicate what they had at work, because they wanted to, because it was fun. They took obsolete or broken components home and fixed them To hack nano is to bring it out of the obscurity and the secrecy-driven government, profit-driven corporations, and academic institutions, and into your garage, into your basement, into your room. The slide with all that fancy equipment. Bring that equipment into your room. Become a garage engineer. Create that equipment and then use that equipment to build nanoscale devices. Garage engineers is a term a friend of mine had coined. I don't know if he made it up or whatever. It just happened to be the subject of a long chain of emails that we'd conversed back and forth. And so garage engineers with hacker mindsets can develop nanotechnology to new levels. This is breaking the barriers, discovering new things, pushing it to levels that it hasn't been conceived of. How much time do I have left? All right, I got to get on to the demonstration. So start building tools. One of the main questions I was asked while working in my garage or working on my porch is, what am I building? I didn't really know how to explain that. I was just building something, which is a tool, but they wanted to know what I was going to make with it. It wasn't going to make anything until after I made it. So I had to build it first. I had to build the tool first. And now I need to think of what I want to do with that tool. So what are you building was a really hard question for me to answer sometimes. Some of the tools I feel, which are reproducible on a budget for hackers, are vacuum technology, plasma technology, and e-beam technology. I believe so because they're pretty easy to recreate and pretty easy to observe the effects of. Some of the things in nanotechnology don't have an observable effect unless you have equipment which you can see that. These things are things which you can see very quickly. And they're useful. And they're also fun. And they're cheap. Vacuum. Vacuum lowers the pressure of a chamber. I've built a vacuum pump using a household air conditioner compressor. Plumbing supplies from a hardware store. And it creates an atmosphere with less chance of contamination for future processes. Vacuum doesn't really do anything by itself, but later on it will be useful. Plasma, it's a fourth state of matter. It's a highly energized gas. It contains neutrals, ions, electrons, photons, and many other things. Sometimes plasmas require a vacuum. The reason why plasma is important is because it can etch and also deposit materials on a nanometer scale or on a micron scale. An example of a plasma is fluorescent lighting. I'll get to that later. E-beam technology. Where can we get e-beams quickly and easily? It's a beam of electrons accelerated towards a target. If anybody is into electronics, a quick, dirty e-beam to get real fast is a black and white TV. It's a single e-beam. A cathode ray tube is an electron gun. We do have to make some serious modifications to a TV in order to get it to become our e-beam tool and have control over where it moves, because a TV uses scanning and rastering to generate the image. What we desire is a single dot that we can scan and raster ourselves. And vacuum is definitely required for electron beam. Got some links here. You can go to hacknano.com after I get home from this event, and I'll have the full presentation up on the internet. So that's that. On to the demonstration. Beginning of the summer, it's a little red tool cart I didn't pay very much money for, and I've started to modify it greatly in order to become a medium for me to do my experiments on and build my tools and be able to take it out to the 2600 meetings. LV2600, for anybody in the crowd, is where I end up taking a lot of the results of my experiments and demonstrating there. In the middle layer is the vacuum system that I've developed. The compressor is over there. It's the cylindrical black device. Using standard plumbing equipment obtained from any hardware store, I created the plumbing system. It's a series of valves and fittings. Also, this gauge up here, I can spin around this way. We get a good shot of it. This gauge here is a pressure and vacuum gauge obtained from an automotive store for $20. I think it's about the most expensive piece on this whole cart that I actually had to pay money out of pocket for. The valves were kind of expensive. They were like $5 a piece. But this gauge goes from 0 to 30 inches and 1 to 10 PSI. I've never used PSI on this. I've only ever had to use the vacuum. A demonstration of vacuum technology here will be that all around us are 15 pounds per square inch of pressure exerted by the air. Inside this balloon and outside this balloon is 15 pounds per square inch. Using a vacuum, I can remove the air. That's kind of big. I can remove the air that is inside the jar, but maintaining the fact that there's 15 pounds per square inch, that's not going to fit. So I need another one. What color you guys want? All right. There we go. Blue. All right. By removing the pressure outside of the balloon, the 15 pounds per square inch, which is inside the balloon, is able to expand. What we will see is that the balloon will expand. Using a series of plumbing supplies and the compressor pump from an air conditioner, which take to an air conditioning serviceman to have vented. Do not cut an air conditioner apart and bleed the nasty chemicals straight into the atmosphere. Let's have some respect for our environment. And so I'm going to set the valves for my test to make sure that the pump is working. It's kind of noisy. All right, and we don't need this just yet. Can we get a close-up of the gauge? Will we be actually able to see the numbers on the gauge? All right, we can see the needle moving when I do that. When I close this valve, it'll be sucking down on itself, and it quickly jumps to 29, 28 inches. That's the valve, or the gauge. I was just demonstrating that quickly. Let me remind everyone, in Area C, I'll be taking all this equipment and giving a more thorough demonstration because I'm kind of rushing right now. I'm going to open the valve for the chamber, close the test valve, and turn it on. I'm also going to turn off the gauge valve because it's leaky. We see the balloon expanding and has filled the chamber because we've removed 15 pounds per square inch inside the chamber. I've locked the vacuum in there with a valve so it'll stay for a little bit. I use a rubber for the sealing of the glass onto the base plate. It's not the most efficient way for a vacuum seal, but it's worked for my demonstrations. Another interesting aspect of this experiment is that when I open the chamber and vent it, the balloon is warm to the touch because of the compression of air. Yeah, just making sure I had that right. All right. The next demonstration will be a demonstration of plasma, a highly energized form of gas containing electrons, neutrals, ions, and photons. Photons is the key word here. Inside a fluorescent tube is a phosphor powder on the outside, the white powder, but inside the middle, it's been evacuated and filled with the mercury vapor. It's pretty constant right now. It's not really doing anything. When it's subjected to the effects of the ballast, there's a current flow from end to end, which creates collisions inside the mercury vapor, which releases photons. Those photons are in the UV range, and they strike the phosphors. The phosphors emit the white light that we're all familiar with seeing. We don't have to use the ballast to get the mercury atoms excited enough to start creating collisions and photons. We can use microwave energy. If you guys want to dim the lights. This is a microwave, a common household microwave I've modified for my experiment by cutting a hole in the side. No, this is not safe if you do not know what you're doing. I've had many hours of conversations with a microwave engineer, and he's explained to me some of the safety precautions of doing this. I actually wasn't going to do this experiment today, but I've decided that I would, because he reassured me that it is pretty safe and the power levels we're working with are relatively low. Oh, yeah. Now, you need filaments inside a fluorescent tube in order to get the plasma to strike, because the filaments emit the electrons which start the collisions inside the mercury vapor. This tube's been burned out. The actual filaments in here are vaporized. They're fried. They're black powder on the ends of this tube. But the mercury vapor inside here is still good. So by using a burned out tube, we can demonstrate that the filaments are not necessary. Some safety precautions about microwaves. Safety first. I mean, in everything you do, safety first. Safety about a microwave, don't stick your hand in it. Don't rig the door to open with the microwave on, or don't rig it so the microwave can work with the door open. Soft edges, no sharp corners, no points. I have a square cut opening. I don't know if the dimensions are accurate, but I'm not a microwave engineer. First thing I have, and don't touch anything in here because it's very dangerous. Many, many thousand of volts. And when you do microwave experiments and you've read enough to understand them, you should normally keep a glass of water inside them to absorb extra microwaves. And because if not, they bounce around in this chamber and go back into the magnetron here and burn it up very quickly. This experiment will be very short, and I've determined that the water absorbs too much of the microwaves to not give the full glowing effect. So, and plus this microwave I picked up a couple days ago, so I can afford to lose it. Oh yeah, it's fine. First thing I'm going to do is set the clock, because this thing is stupid and needs the clock set in order to cook. Then I'm going to set cook time. And it's not going to run for very long. I'll do it a couple of times in a row so people can get some pictures. The danger here is that we vaporize the filaments that are in there, creating a positive pressure inside the tube and exploding the glass. That does happen. Do not put incandescent lights inside a microwave. I haven't tried it yet with a fluorescent. So do not put an incandescent light bulb in a microwave and turn it on. It will vaporize the filament, creating a pressure and exploding the glass. And it's very loud. All right. All right. Is everyone ready? Is the audio system capable of a second run for those who didn't get a picture the first time? I'll do a demonstration in Area C after this. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Let's get some questions up here real quick. Sure. What do you got? The significance of what?
The second
experiment. What can you do with the plasma? All right. Right now, the plasma, this was just more of a showy demonstration, but if you may notice on my cart, I have extra valves which aren't being used. Later on, I'll be injecting gases through there, nitrous oxide or carbon dioxide, which are too easy to obtain gases. So I don't have to use a mercury vapor. I could also use a nitrous oxide vapor. So I can fill the chamber with a gas, and then using another microwave mounted close to the chamber, or even just electronics, electricity and electrostatics, I could create a plasma. This plasma doesn't really do anything except for light up the light using the photons, but if I were to ground a target positive ions would bombard that target and etch it. I could also have special species of gases which would create precipitation and deposit layers of chemicals on a target. So this was just to demonstrate that what a plasma is. Here it is. I was touching it. You can do that on the cart. I just haven't got there yet. Sure. All right, etch rate is the key word there in plasma technology. That's controlled by the power of the microwave, but more importantly, by the voltage and the polarity of the target. Also, the pressure chamber creates an important factor in how fast an object or how fast the plasma etches or deposits. That's why vacuum is the first thing I attempted to do. One, because it was completely safe, in my opinion. And two, it's very important. I would consider it the most important aspect of nanotechnology is having a vacuum, a good vacuum. Right there.
Could you go into a little bit more detail about what needs to be done to a cathode ratio, electron gun, to make it useful for etching?
To make an e-beam out of a black and white TV, take the TV apart. Please make sure it's unplugged. Take a screwdriver and rub it across the back of the circuit board or directly short out the main capacitor in there, because we're talking thousands of volts again, which will kill you. After you've had those safety precautions achieved, take the deflection coil, which is the winding of copper on the back. Sometimes it's glued on there, sometimes it's clamped on there. Break that, or don't break it off, but pull it off. You can't disconnect it because it's used in the circuitry to generate the beam. So just pull it off and set it to the side. Now you have a single dot. Turn your contrast and your brightness down to a minimum, and then turn it back up so you just have a small dim dot, or else you'll burn the phosphor screen in the front. The next logical step would be to break the screen, get the cathode ray tube, the e-gun out, and reassemble it inside a vacuum of your own. The cathode ray tube is a glass vacuum. It's been pumped out. Reassemble it on your nano cart, and pump it down and turn it on and see what happens. Also, if you're careful while breaking the TV screen, do that. There's a small nub on the back of the TV screen. If you tap it, it will vent it safely without imploding it. But after that, use a hammer and some protection. Smash the screen and save a portion of the phosphor coated screen. Set that in front of the e-beam, and you'll be able to tell when you've actually created an electron beam, because they're invisible. Also, to detect a plasma, break a fluorescent tube outside. Don't break fluorescent tubes inside, because they do contain mercury vapor, and the phosphor coating is carcinogenic. Save pieces of phosphor-coated fluorescent tube glass and keep them inside your vacuum chamber. If you have a plasma, which is generating photons, it will light up. Last question?
Why black and white TV?
I chose a black and white TV for simplicity. A color TV has three electron guns in it. I'm not a real big TV repair guy, but I do know that messing around with one circuitry is much easier than messing around with three circuitry. So that's why I decided to go with a black and white TV. You could very well use a color TV and only use one of the colors, or combine all three. But by using one, you simplify the design a lot. All right. Absolute last question, then we got to wrap.
What are you going to do next with all the
experiments? My plans for the Hack Nano project, develop more tools. I'd like to develop an atomic force microscope. And one of the major goals I have set for this project is to recreate the experiments from IBM, Don Eigler at IBM, who spelled IBM using xenon atoms and an atomic force microscope. I believe when people like us who sit in our garages and do this for fun and exploration, when we can recreate those experiments, we've achieved a major goal in society, I believe. All right, so Area C in a little bit, and I will do this again, maybe have a more personable, hands-on, more personable demonstration of my equipment. Thank you very much for attending. How'd I do?